He writes that he had been neurotic for years, anxious and depressed and selfish. Like so many of us, he adopted one self-improvement project after another, and when nothing seemed to work, he was on the verge of despair. Part of what was so painful was that even his friends agreed that he needed to change and regularly urged him to become less self-absorbed. His world stopped one day when a friend told him, "Don't change. I love you just as you are." Letting those words stream through his heart and mind felt like pure grace. Don't change. Don't change. Don't change. I love you as you are. Paradoxically, it was only when he received permission not to that he felt free to change. Father DeMello says he relaxed and opened to a feeling of aliveness that had been blocked off for years. When others accept us exactly as we are, it does not mean they like everything we do. It does not mean that they will passively stand by if we are injuring ourselves or others. If we are lucky, our friends and family will jump in to intervene if we become alcoholic or start gambling away our paycheck. They will let us know when we have hurt their feelings. And if we are luckier still, they will make it clear that they continue to love us, that they accept the human confusion behind the hurtful ways we express our pain. Loving acceptance combined with forthright honesty are the key components in what substance abuse professionals call an intervention. My mother, Nancy Brock, who has worked for decades in the field of addiction recovery, describes an intervention as a session in which carefully coached codependents confront their alcoholic or drug abuser in a loving, non-judgmental manner. Even though the approach is confrontational, as she writes, substance abuse professionals drop the old adage that you must wait until your client is ready before guiding him or her into a 12-step recovery program. Too many addicts died before being ready, and their families were plenty ready to kill them before being dragged further into the dregs. When addiction is destroying the life of someone's family, friends, and co-workers, they can arrange for such a session. A bed is booked in advance so the addict can, it is hoped, go directly from the session into a treatment program. One of my mother's favorite intervention stories is a good example of the power of radical acceptance. She writes, "I didn't think Harry was ever going to make it to that reserved bed. His repeated bouts of binging already were showing in the small, bright veins of his cheeks and eyes, in his extra watery weight. His behavior was grandiose and unpredictable, and he was about to lose his job. I worried about how the participants, his wife, two sons, and elderly father, were going to manage being loving and non-judgmental when each one was so furious with him. They were filled with grievances. The sons who couldn't bring friends home from school because their father was such a loose cannon. The wife who had lost a partner she could count on and who treated her with care. The father who never saw his only son. I feared they'd just curse him out rather than communicate their caring. I was wrong. Harry came into that room, and he later told me, looked around at the faces of those he loved best in the whole world. They were all looking at him, all there for him. Something happened to the air in the room, he said. It seemed to beat like a pulse. After he sank down in a chair, I suggested that Marge, his wife, begin the confrontation. But instead of reciting his absences, his missed commitments, she just got up and kissed him. 'Thank you for coming, Harry,' she said. Then, to my surprise, each of the others, even the boys, got up and hugged him. It was hard to see what happened after that. All of us were in tears. When his family did go on to say what needed saying, Harry was listening. Afterward, he took the bed that had been saved for him. That was about 15 years ago, and as far as I know, Harry is still attending his 12-step meetings and still aware of the courageous love the acceptance and truth-telling that probably saved his life. Witnessing the power of radical acceptance always amazes me. I have seen people who for years had carried shameful secrets join a 12-step group or spiritual friends group, which I describe shortly, and feel immediately and profoundly relieved. Because they realize they are human, imperfect, and still lovable, they can breathe deeply and start fresh. I saw how after several months of being held in a group's loving acceptance, one of my clients became capable of intimacy with her partner in a way that had seemed impossible. I've watched people shift careers and pursue work that truly inspires them just because they experienced acceptance. It is as if radical acceptance opens the door of our cage and invites us to move freely in our world. Walking the path with spiritual friends. We use the word friend so casually that we forget its power and depth. Friendliness is one of the main translations of the Pali word metta, or loving kindness. The love and understanding of a friend, like a deep well of the purest water, refreshes the very source of our being. If all religions and great ideologies disappeared and our one pursuit was friendship, unconditional friendliness with each other, our inner life, all nature, ah, what a world! Being with good friends helps us relax about our inner weather and stop regarding our painful emotions or confused behaviors as symptoms of spiritual backsliding. As we bring our vulnerability, insight, and heart into conscious relationship, we realize we are all waking up together. In this environment of togetherness, deep healing becomes possible. One of my meditation students, Karen, was struggling through a divorce from a man she had been married to for 15 years, and they were embroiled in a nasty custody battle. Karen felt as if her life were falling apart, and that she was alone and isolated in her battle. When Karen came to talk with me about how to handle her anger and self-doubt, I suggested she consider joining one of our meditation community's spiritual support groups. Called Kalyanamitta, in Pali, spiritual friends, these groups first emerged among students and teachers at Spirit Rock Meditation Center outside San Francisco. They so effectively filled a need that they soon popped up in Buddhist meditation communities around the country. Groups usually have about 8 members, and most meet every other week. A typical meeting starts with a period of silent meditation and opens into mindful dialogue. The topic might be the challenges of being spiritually awake in daily life, whether that means in work or intimate relationships, in facing an addiction or the fear of weakness and death. Sometimes the discussion revolves around deepening formal practice. Whatever the focus, the shared intention of group members is to speak and listen honestly, to be present, and to communicate from the heart. Karen was immediately interested and began attending Kalyanamitta KM meetings. There, she was relieved to find she could talk about her feelings of rage, impotence, and fear, and not feel out of place or judged. She could even admit to ugly behaviors, ways she lost her temper and went into screaming fits when she felt criticized or misled by her ex-husband. The group's gentle acceptance helped Karen to trust that this, too, could be accepted as part of the path. Her out-of-control reactions didn't make her bad. They were not some non-spiritual derailment. Rather, the painful emotions were a call to deepen her attention and practice compassion. As others within the group talked about confusing and messy parts of their lives, Karen could see she wasn't out of place. I used to go to meditation gatherings and think that everyone else was so still and peaceful, like they were all realizing their Buddha nature or something. Meanwhile, I was the one neurotic person in the room, caught in non-stop obsessing about my dramas. Now she was realizing that the moods and storms each might experience did not define them. Like the weather, these would change and pass. Furthermore, being with a group of spiritual friends helped her remember what she valued about herself, her empathy and humor and intuitive wisdom. Belonging to this KM group changed how Karen related not only to herself, but also to Richard, her ex-husband. Through their marriage, Karen had come to believe that her easily bruised feelings meant she was weak, that her need for affection and reassurance was a sign of basic insecurity. Yet after months of being in a KM group with others who shared her hurts and fears, she now knew nothing was wrong with her. Instead of feeling overwhelmed, crushed, or furious each time she had to interact with Richard, she had developed a deeper confidence, a firmer center. At one meeting, Karen related an incident that happened several days earlier. She had been on the phone with Richard, discussing whether their oldest daughter, Melanie, should transfer to a private school. Richard made a nasty comment about how he hoped that her insecurities weren't rubbing off, causing their daughter's discontent at public school. Karen felt a hot surge of anger, but didn't say anything. Instead, she imagined the KM group, the now familiar and caring faces. She remembered feeling their acceptance and felt a huge wash of gratitude that she no longer needed to believe his story about her defects and limitations. Karen still felt annoyed and quickly ended the conversation. But she also felt excited and hopeful. By feeling supported and accepted, she had been able to step out of the old reactive dance with Richard. Karen's growing self-trust served her well as she tried to help her daughter sort out which school might be best for her. Because she was more relaxed, she could listen openly to Melanie's concerns and fears without feeling overwhelmed or inadequate. Together, they met with her high school guidance counselor and visited the Quaker school her daughter wanted to attend. "The more I listened to Melanie, the more clearly I realized she was right about what she needed," Karen told me. "I knew this new school would be wonderful for her." When she next talked to Richard, he didn't even argue. "I guess he could get on board because I was on board. I had some confidence in myself." The acceptance Karen had received from her spiritual friends had taken root. Her faith in herself was enabling her to relate to those around her with a growing sense of balance and strength. When radical acceptance blossoms in our relationships, it becomes a kind of spiritual reparenting that enables us to trust the goodness and beauty of who we really are. Just as good parenting mirrors back to a child that they are lovable, when we understand and accept others, we affirm their intrinsic worth and belonging. To receive this kind of radical acceptance can transform our lives. By mirroring back to someone their goodness, we offer a priceless gift, and its blessings ripple out through a lifetime. Rachel Naomi Remen writes, "When we recognize the spark of God in others, we blow on it with our attention and strengthen it. No matter how deeply it has been buried or for how long, when we bless someone, we touch the unborn goodness in them and wish it well. The mirroring of inner beauty is the blessing any of us can give to each other. We only need to pause, see clearly who is before us, and open wide our heart. Some of our deepest awakenings happen through the intimate and loving connections that remind us most fully of who we are." Sufi teacher Idris Shah tells the story of a dervish who was so wise and beloved that every time he sat down at one of his favorite coffee houses, he would be immediately surrounded by students and devotees. While he was humble and did not proclaim to be someone special, these very qualities were part of the vibrant aura that attracted his followers. The dervish was asked various questions about spiritual life, but the most frequent was personal. "How did you become so holy?" Invariably, he would simply reply, "I know what is in the Quran." This went on for quite a while until one day, after hearing this response, a rather arrogant newcomer challenged him. Well, what is in the Quran? He demanded. After regarding him kindly, the dervish responded, In the Quran, there are two pressed flowers, and a letter from my friend Abdullah. Although scriptures guide us and practices focus and quiet us, as the dervish suggested, the living experience of love reveals our intrinsic wholeness and radiance. Our life is embedded in an interdependent field of being, and when we are relating consciously, when, as Rumi says, our friendship is made of being awake, the suffering of our personal trance dissolves. Pain is not personal. Michael Mead, renowned storyteller and teacher, tells about a healing ritual in Zambia. If a member of the tribe becomes ill, emotionally or physically, the belief is that an ancestor's tooth has lodged itself within the person and is responsible for the sickness. Because all members of the tribe are connected with each other, the suffering of one affects the others, and all become involved in healing. The tribe's healing ritual is based on the understanding that, as Mead relates, the tooth will come out as the truth comes out. While the sick person must reveal the rage or hatred or lust he or she is experiencing, for the full truth to be revealed, each person in the tribe must express his or her own buried hurts and fears, anger and disappointment. As Mead describes it, the release happens only when everything comes out, in the midst of dancing and singing and drumming. The whole village gets cleansed by the release of the tooth through the release of these difficult truths. This ritual holds great wisdom. Unlike in our culture, where we consider illness or depression to be a personal liability or affliction, members of this tribe are not blamed or isolated in their suffering. Rather, suffering is a shared concern, a part of everyone's life. Pain does not belong to one individual. Not taking pain personally is essential to radical acceptance. As the Buddha taught, life's difficulties are not owned or caused by an individual. Our changing states of body and mind are influenced by myriad variables. When we recognize this, remaining open and vulnerable and accepting with each other, we heal together. Not taking our pain personally is a profound shift away from our habitual way of regarding our life. Even when we are trying not to judge ourselves, it is easy to assume that our jealous thoughts, our selfish tendencies, our compulsions, and our often non-stop judging are a personal problem and sign of deficiency. But if we pay close attention to others, as Karen did in the KM group, or as the Zambian tribe does, we see that we are not alone in our wants and fears. We also see that we share the same longing to be more loving and awake, realizing the truth of belonging, that we are all suffering and awakening together on the path, is the most powerful antidote to personal feelings of unworthiness. When my fear or my shame becomes our shared suffering, radical acceptance flowers. Habitual feelings of separation arise throughout life. This is simply a part of our condition. When asked about how to deal with these persistent feelings of distance from each other, the Indian master Sri Nisargadatta gave this simple, beautiful advice. Just let go of every thought except, I am God, you are God. By relating to each other with radical acceptance, we affirm the truth of who we are. When in friendship, we release all distancing thoughts and ideas. When we behold each other with clarity and love, we nourish the seeds of liberation. Guided reflection, communicating with awareness. The way we speak with and listen to others can communicate love or hate, acceptance or rejection. The Buddha described wise speech, the speech that expresses reverence for life, as speaking only what is true and what is helpful. Yet caught as we are in reacting to each other out of wanting and fear, how do we recognize what is true? How do we discern what is helpful? How do we speak and listen from our hearts? The following meditative practices are guidelines for being mindful and open-hearted in communicating with each other. They have been drawn from different sources and are used in varying combinations by Kalyanamitta and similar groups around the United States. You can practice them yourself whenever you are engaged in conversation, or you can use them as formal guidelines for interpersonal meditation, where two or more people are gathered for the purpose of mindful dialogue. Set your intention. As a basic spiritual practice, establish your intention to be present, honest, and kind in relating to others in any circumstance. Remind yourself of your resolution at the start of each day, at the beginning of an interpersonal meditation, or before any interaction with others. Let your body be an anchor. Choose two or three touch points, places in your body where you can reawaken a sense of presence. These might be the sensations of breathing, the sensations in your shoulders, hands, stomach, or feet. Return to them as often as possible when you are communicating with others. The more you practice staying aware of these touch points during your sitting practice and throughout the day, the more readily you'll sustain an embodied presence when you are with others. Listen from the heart. While others are speaking, try to let go of your own thoughts and pay attention to what they are saying. This means letting go of your agenda for the conversation. Stay aware of the feelings and sensations that occur throughout your body, and especially in the heart area. Be particularly aware of your mind wandering off into judgments. If you find yourself criticizing, analyzing, or interpreting, meet these thoughts with mindfulness, let them go, and return to receptive listening. This doesn't mean you are agreeing with whatever is being said, but rather you are honoring the other by offering your full presence and attention. Let your listening be wholehearted and deep, paying attention to the person's tone, pitch, volume, and words. In addition to content, allow yourself to receive the mood and spirit of what another is expressing. Speak from the heart. Try not to prepare and rehearse what you will say in advance, especially while another is speaking. Rather, in the present moment, speak what feels true and meaningful. This might be a response to what you have just heard, or, as happens in meditative dialogue, it may not be necessary to respond. Rather, what you say arises from your immediate stream of experience. Speaking from the heart begins with inward listening. Speak slowly enough to stay mindfully connected with your body and heart. Pause, relax, and attend. During your interactions, pause repeatedly. Pause briefly before and after you speak. Pause as you are speaking to reconnect with your body and feelings. Pause when another is done speaking, giving some space for what they have said to settle. With each pause, relax your body and mind. Rest in openness, paying full attention to this moment's experience. After pausing, you might deepen your attention by using inquiry to check in with your own heart and mind. Ask yourself, what is true now? What am I feeling? Deepen your awareness of the other by asking yourself, what might this person be experiencing? This inquiry is both active and receptive. You are intentionally asking and investigating, and also opening to whatever is arising. Use pause, relax, attend whenever you remember as a sacred pathway into presence. Practice radical acceptance. The effort to be present and awake with each other is very humbling. The given is that we will forget our intention, forget to connect with our body, forget to listen without thinking, forget not to rehearse, forget, forget, forget. Hold the whole process with radical acceptance, forgiving yourself and others again and again for being perfectly imperfect. When radical acceptance is a container for our relationships, genuine intimacy becomes possible. Training ourselves to be present with each other is a way to integrate mindfulness and loving kindness into our daily life. In the moments when we communicate with honesty and kindness, we begin to dissolve the trance of separation. Instead of being driven by wanting or fear, we feel increasingly spontaneous and real. As much as any meditation, these practices allow us to discover, through relating wakefully with each other, the sweetness of our connectedness and belonging. 12. Realizing our true nature. O longing mind, dwell within the depth of your own pure nature. Do not seek your home elsewhere. Your naked awareness alone, O mind, is the inexhaustible abundance for which you long so desperately. Sri Ramakrishna. A legend from ancient India tells of a musk deer who one fresh spring day detected a mysterious and heavenly fragrance in the air. It hinted of peace, beauty, and love, and like a whisper, beckoned him onward. Compelled to find its source, he set out, determined to search the whole world over. He climbed forbidding and icy mountain peaks, padded through steamy jungles, trekked across endless desert sands. Wherever he went, the scent was there, faint, yet always detectable. At the end of his life, exhausted from his relentless search, the deer collapsed. As he fell, his horn pierced his belly, and suddenly the air was filled with the heavenly scent. As he lay dying, the musk deer realized that the fragrance had all along been emanating from within himself. When we are trapped in the trance of feeling separate and unworthy, Buddha nature appears to be outside of us. Spiritual awakening, if it is even possible for this flawed self, seems to be far away, in another time or place. We might imagine that realization happened only in Asia, centuries ago, or in monasteries, or to those who are far more devoted and disciplined than we are. Even if we follow their path, we may be like the musk deer. We may spend our lives seeking something that is actually right inside us, and could be found if we would only stop and deepen our attention. But distracted, we spend our life on our way to somewhere else. As we spiritually mature, our yearning to see truth and live with an open heart becomes more compelling than our reflex to avoid pain and chase after pleasure. We may feel mistreated and angry at our partner, but we are willing to recognize our part, to see their pain, to forgive and keep loving. When we become lonely or sad, we are less inclined to dull the painful feelings with food, drugs, or staying busy. We become increasingly aligned with our evolutionary destiny, which is to awaken into our natural wisdom and compassion. Our true and original nature is described in Mahayana Buddhism as Prajnaparamita, the heart of perfect wisdom. This perfection of wisdom is called the mother of all Buddhas, the one who shows the world as it is. She is called the source of light, so that all fear and distress may be forsaken. When we are in touch with our true nature, we are completely free of the trance, no longer afraid or contracted. We know our deepest essence as the pure, wakeful awareness that beholds with love all of creation. We may at times have a sudden and profound insight into our true nature. However, making ourselves at home in this truth, trusting it in our day-to-day living, usually depends upon a gradual unfolding. For this reason, the process of realizing who we are is called a path of awakening. While a path implies getting somewhere else and different, in spiritual life, The path opens us to the awareness and love that, as T.S. Eliot writes, is here, now, always. Doubting our Buddha nature. I was in the middle of a week-long meditation retreat when our teacher posed a simple and profound question. Do you really trust you are a Buddha? My inner response was, absolutely, sometimes. Countless times I had perceived my heart and mind awakening into freedom. In those moments, trust arose from a full-body realization that my original nature is pure awareness. When I was resting in that truth, I felt fully real and at home. Yet I knew that I also spent huge swaths of time each day believing I was a small self who was falling short and needed to be different in order to be okay. Wishing to become more mindful of this persistent illusion of a small self, during the remainder of the retreat, I periodically asked myself, "Who am I taking myself to be?" I was a meditator carried away by obsessive thinking and not trying hard enough. I was a woman wearing clothes that were too sexy and immodest for a Buddhist retreat. I was a judgmental person, running a constant commentary in my mind about how others appeared and behaved. I was a self-conscious yogi wanting to impress my teacher during our interview. The question proved to be a very useful tool in revealing how fully and how often I slipped into the trance. I could see that whenever I took myself to be some version of a small self, I wasn't recognizing or trusting the wakeful presence that is my deepest nature. While not always intense, some feeling of fear and separation was always present. In the aftermath of that retreat, my habit of mistrusting my true nature seemed even more extreme. One morning, while Narayan was getting ready to leave for school, I was meditating in my bedroom. My mind was fairly quiet and still, and rather than focusing attention, I was simply resting in awareness. As images, sounds, and sensations arose and dissolved in the boundless space of mind, I perceived the beautiful freedom of not clinging to anything and felt enormous tenderness for the world. The scent of Buddha nature was vibrant and immediate. I felt as wide open as the sky, as wakeful as a radiant sun. There was nowhere to go. Nothing was missing or outside of awareness. In the midst of this sitting, there was a loud knock on the door, and Narayan barged into my room. Apologetic and breathless, he asked me for a ride to school. He had run as fast and hard as he could, but still missed the bus. My open, shining universe suddenly collapsed into the roles and duties of being a mom. I agreed, threw on some jeans, and we headed out the door. As we crept slowly through Washington's aggressive rush-hour traffic, I became increasingly edgy. When I asked him if he felt prepared for today's science quiz, he mumbled, "Not exactly." Further questioning revealed that he had forgotten to take his lab notes home the prior day. I stopped myself from making my typical observations on how he organized his life, or from saying anything punitive. But inside, I could feel my gut tighten with irritation. When he made his habitual move for the radio, I muttered, "No way," and angrily pushed his hand away. Rap was just too much. As I felt the grim set of my jaw and the tightness of my mind, I reminded myself that this, too, was another opportunity to practice mindfulness. But this reminder was only an abstraction. The concrete reality was I felt uptight and armored, a neurotic mother trapped in reactivity. The awareness I cherished and had so recently known as my true nature was a fragrance somewhere out there, distant and far away. It had nothing to do with the person making her way through the traffic. When I returned home and pulled into my driveway, I turned off the car and just sat there. Sometimes the protective bubble of my car can be as good a space for touching the moment as the most sacred of meditation halls. At first I felt restless and had to resist the urge to dash inside and check my email and phone messages. Instead, I waited, feeling my body and sensing what most wanted attention. As I sat there, I could see the squirrels chasing each other around the trees in my side yard. My feelings were also chasing each other around, and I knew there was nothing to do but let them play out. In the hunch of my shoulders and the creeping sensations of fatigue, I recognized the feeling of failure. I'd felt so peaceful and expansive just moments before my son had entered the room. How could I contract so suddenly, feel so inadequate, so irritated, so tight? I was falling short on all fronts, meditating, mothering, living life. This feeling of self-doubt was familiar. Would I ever be able to sustain a caring and open presence through life's daily ups and downs? At the culminating moment of Gautama Buddha's awakening, he faced the enormous force of doubt. He had spent the night under the Bodhi tree, responding with mindfulness and compassion to all the various challenges of Mara, the god of greed, hatred, and delusion. As night was beginning to fade, Gautama knew that his heart and mind were awake, but he was not yet fully free. Mara then issued his final and most difficult challenge. By what right did Siddhartha aspire to Buddhahood? In other words, who do you think you are? This voice of Mara is the one that urges us to turn against ourselves, to give up the path, convincing us that we are going nowhere. In response to this challenge, Gautama reached down and touched the earth, calling on it to bear witness to his many lifetimes of compassion. In touching the earth, he was also touching the ground of wakeful presence, the heart of perfect wisdom from which all enlightened beings spring. He was calling on his true identity to dispel all the doubt that kept him from complete freedom. According to the legend, at the moment when he touched the ground, the earth trembled and the sky was filled with rumbling. Mara, seeing that he was facing not a man, but the creative power of awareness itself, fearfully withdrew. Sitting in my car that morning, I remembered to hold my chaos of feelings with radical acceptance. The tightness and hardness around my heart started to soften. Acknowledging and allowing the very immediate pain of self-doubt, I began to feel more real and awake. As the minutes passed, I felt myself returning to a caring and open awareness. The squirrels had stopped their mad circling around the tree trunk, and a light wind was moving through the leaves. Inside, I felt a growing sense of calm. Doubt was still there, but I was no longer taking myself to be a failing mother or inept meditator. It was more like the whisper of an uneasy, cautious self. As a way of continuing to free myself from any sense of contraction into selfness, I asked myself, "Who is aware right now?" I was aware only of awareness. There was no self to locate. There was no entity that was failing, no self that was fearful and distraught, no foothold for self-doubt. While streams of sensations and emotions were moving through my body and mind, there was no one behind the scenes who possessed them or controlled them. I could find only the endless space of awareness, formless, open, knowing. Just as the Buddha touched the earth in response to Mara's final challenge, when the voice of doubt afflicts us, we touch the ground by arriving on the spot in this moment. We touch the ground by directly connecting with the earth, the life of our bodies, our breath, and our inner weather. We touch the ground by looking directly into the awareness that is the very source of our life. As we connect with what is right in front of us, we realize the true immensity of who we are. Seeing beyond the self and letting go into awareness. When we sit down to meditate, we begin with our immediate experience. As we offer a kind presence to the areas that are most calling for our attention, our body and mind begin to quiet. If we look closely, we recognize that our sense of self begins to loosen. At this point, there is a tendency to get caught up in a subtle but persistent contraction that still feels like me. I am the one who is calming down, or the one guiding myself in meditation. This more diffuse and edgeless sense of self is what I call a ghost self. Some call it the observing witness, or the self who is watching. Though less entrapping than an angry or fearful self, this ghost self is still a hanging on to an identity that prevents us from being free. The Buddha taught that holding on to anything, including a sense of being the observer, obscures the full freedom of awareness. At these times, as I did in the driveway, we can pull the curtain on this faint aura of selfness by asking, "Who is aware?" We might also ask, "What is aware?" or "Who am I?" or "Who is thinking?" We bring mindfulness to awareness itself. We look into awareness. By inquiring and then looking into awareness, we can cut through and dispel the deepest illusions of self that have held us separate and bound. Jim had been attending my weekly meditation classes for 8 months. He had approached me after class several times in frustration. Each time his mind quieted enough to look into awareness, he would end up sensing a witness self. When he asked, "Who is aware of this witnessing self?" the observing self would just pop up again. Worried that he wasn't getting it, he came up again one night after class. I asked him to bring mindfulness to the sensations, images, and mood of the witness self he perceived, and to tell me what he noticed. He said he saw a cloud of light behind him and heard his own voice saying, "This is me." I asked, "Who is aware of the light, the sound of a voice?" His response was immediate. "I am, of course." He told me he felt irritated, as if someone, me, Buddhism, was challenging the self that he absolutely knew to be real. After some moments, his annoyance turned to discouragement, and Jim said flatly, "I don't know what I'm supposed to do. I'm confused, and this whole meditation makes me uncomfortable." In looking into awareness, if we are anxious and trying to have a particular experience, our attention, rather than being unbiased and allowing, fixates on thoughts, sounds, or sensations. Rather than recognizing and accepting the changing stream of phenomena, we feel compelled to grasp hold of something, anything. To try to orient ourselves, we take a mental snapshot of our experience and add a commentary. While we might initially look into awareness without ideas or expectations, within moments we are back into our conceptual mind trying to make sense of what is happening. The most basic way we do this is by holding on to the concept of a stable and enduring self. We try to secure our identity by nailing down our experience. I encouraged Jim to explore how he might relax more fully while he practiced looking into awareness. I shared with him the instructions my Tibetan meditation teacher, Tsakni Rinpoche, gives for recognizing our true nature. Look and see. Let go and be free. Rinpoche illustrates this by first holding his hands up about a foot in front of his face, palms facing outward. Our attention, like our palms, turned outward, is always focusing on the movie of life, our outer as well as our inner world. Turning his palms toward himself, he demonstrates the act of looking directly into awareness. Look and see. Releasing our focus on thoughts and other objects of experience, we look directly at who is looking. Then, with "Let go, be free," Rinpoche's hands drift gently down to rest in his lap. When we look into our awareness and see what is true, we relax, completely letting go into that reality. The following week, Jim stayed after class and told me that while sitting the evening before, he had touched an experience of deep realization. As had happened so many times before, after his mind quieted, he sensed the witness as a familiar sphere of brightness behind him. He became curious and asked, "Who is aware of this?" As he described it, I could feel the tension in my mind wanting to locate me. But the truth was, I couldn't find anything to land on. In that instant, before my mind came up with any explanation, I completely relaxed. That was it. There was nothing solid, nothing holding still. No self was there. The whole world was awareness. In a classic Zen story, the disciple Hui Qia asks his master, Bodhidharma, "Please help me to quiet my mind." Bodhidharma responds by saying, "Bring me your mind so that I can quiet it." After a long moment of silence, Hui Qia says, "But I can't find my mind." "There," Bodhidharma replies with a smile, "I have now quieted your mind." Like Hui Qia, when we look within, there is no entity, no mind substance, no self, no thing we can identify. There is just awareness, open, empty awareness. We can't locate any center, nor can we find an edge to our experience. Unless we anchor ourselves again in thoughts, or grasp after desired sensations or feelings, we have nowhere to stand, no firm ground. This can be disconcerting, scary, incredibly mysterious. While there may be a profusion of activity, sounds, sensations, images, there is no thing to hold on to, no self behind the curtain managing things. This seeing of no thing is what the Tibetan teachers call the supreme seeing. But this emptiness, this no-thingness, is not empty of life. Rather, empty awareness is full with presence, alive with knowing. The very nature of awareness is cognizance, a continuous knowing of the stream of experience. In this moment that you are listening, sounds are heard, vibration is felt, form and color are seen. This knowing happens instantaneously, spontaneously. Like a sunlit sky, awareness is radiant in cognizance and boundless enough to contain all life. As Jim found, to recognize this pure awareness, we need to relax the veil of stories, thoughts, wants, and fears that cover over our natural being. Sri Nisargadatta writes, "The real world is beyond our thoughts and ideas. We see it through the net of our desires divided into pleasure and pain, right and wrong, inner and outer. To see the universe as it is, you must step beyond the net. It is not hard to do so, for the net is full of holes." Our attention is always fixating on something. A flattering comment someone said, our plan for next Saturday, an image of our dirty kitchen, a rerun of an argument. Our reality is the thoughts and dramas we see in our mental movies. We step beyond the net by letting go of our stories and pursuits and turning toward awareness. This is like looking back at the projector and realizing it is actually light that is making the images look alive. We look back into the emptiness that is the creative source of all stories and emotions, into the formless, fertile space that gives rise to all of existence. There, we see the universe as it is. Everything we can possibly see, hear, feel, or imagine This entire world is a fantastic display, appearing and vanishing in awareness. When thoughts arise, where do they come from? Where do they go to? As you explore looking into the space between thoughts, through the holes in the net, you are looking into awareness itself. You might sit quietly and simply listen for a few moments. Notice how sounds arise and dissolve back into formless awareness. Can you notice the beginnings of sounds, the ends of sounds, the spaces between? It is all happening in awareness, known by awareness. To look and see, let go and be free, is revolutionary and counterintuitive. Rather than trying to control or interpret our experience, we train to relax our grip. By wakefully letting go into what is right here, we are carried home into the mystery and beauty that is our deepest nature. Lama Gendun Rinpoche writes, "Happiness cannot be found through great effort and willpower, but is already there in relaxation and letting go. Don't strain yourself. There is nothing to do. Only our search for happiness prevents us from seeing it. Don't believe in the reality of good and bad experiences. They are like rainbows. Wanting to grasp the ungraspable, you exhaust yourself in vain. As soon as you relax this grasping, space is there, open, inviting, and comfortable. So, make use of it. All is yours already. Don't search any further. Nothing to do, nothing to force, nothing to want. And everything happens by itself. The path of awakening is simply a process of wakeful, profound relaxing. We see what is here right now, and we let go into life exactly as it is. How liberating! With practice, recognizing our natural awareness takes less and less of an effort or a sense of doing. Rather than climbing up a hill to get a view, we are learning the art of relaxing back and wakefully inhabiting the whole vista. We look back into awareness and then simply let go into what is seen. We become more at home in awareness than in any story of a self who is falling short or on our way somewhere else. We are at home because we have seen and experienced firsthand the vast and shining presence that is the very source of our being. Realizing our nature as both emptiness and love. In Mahayana Buddhism, the open, wakeful emptiness of awareness is our absolute nature. Our original nature is changeless, unconditioned, timeless, and pure. When we bring this awareness to the relative world of form, love awakens. We meet the ever-changing stream of life, this living, dying, breathing world, with accepting presence and our hearts invariably open. What our mind recognizes as empty awareness, our heart experiences as love. Our being resides in both the unmanifest and the manifest, the absolute and the relative. This truth, embodied in the Heart Sutra, is considered the gem of Mahayana teachings. As the sutra says, form is emptiness. Emptiness is also form. Emptiness is not other than form. Form is not other than emptiness. The formless ocean of awareness gives rise to the varying and endless waves of life. Emotions, trees, people, stars. Seeing that all of life springs from one awareness, we realize our connectedness and feel the fullness of love. In cherishing all living beings with compassion, we recognize the empty, wakeful awareness that is our common source. Loving life and realizing our essence as formless awareness cannot be separated from each other. As a Japanese proverb expresses, seeing pure awareness without engaging lovingly with our life is a daydream. Living in this relative world without vision is a nightmare. We can be tempted, sometimes in pursuit of non-attachment, to distance ourselves from the messy wildness of our bodies and emotions, and from our relationships with each other. This pulling away leaves us in a disembodied daydream that is not grounded in awareness of our living world. On the other hand, if we immerse ourselves in the mental dramas and changing emotions of our lives, without remembering the empty, wakeful awareness that is our original nature, we get lost in the nightmare of identifying as a separate, suffering self. Sometimes our deepest realization of the interdependence of love and emptiness comes when we are facing the anguish of loss. A recent time where this was true for me was in losing my dog, who was one of my best friends. Her name was also Tara, and she was a black standard poodle. She was filled with good humor and play. I had the distinct sense that she was cheering me on during the steep uphills on our running route. As I lost speed, she would start running circles around me. She meant no harm those few times when she dashed in front of me and sent me sprawling on the street. She was surprised, sorry, kind. Many of us know these friendships. They are quiet, often in the background. And yet, they hold our life. Tara got a brain tumor that took over 6 months to diagnose. She became lethargic and uncoordinated, but still followed me around, struggling gamely to be good company. When we realized the problem, I tried hard to save her life. She had her own shelf of medicines and patiently endured several months of radiation treatments. I was holding on tightly, hoping against the odds. The treatment failed, and her pain got worse. Because of the steroids, her fur started coming out in clumps. I'd wake up in the morning and find her at the foot of my bed, with yet another sore red patch of exposed skin. She'd still limply wag her tail or give me a soft, affectionate lick, but she didn't want to meet the day. I felt I had no choice but to end her life. I can so easily remember the trusting look in her eyes as I got her to step onto the steel platform in the vet's office. She was quiet and ready as he injected the chemicals that stopped her heart. When my vet left me alone with Tara's body, I was flooded with the loss, sobbing with grief. I just kept stroking and kissing her dear head, feeling her presence and absence clashing and spinning through me at once. My dear friend was gone. She would never light up in seeing me, run with me, sleep warmly next to me again. Yet this aching, loving bond was so here and alive. Holding her, hugging her, I could feel how this world of beloved forms plays out with relentless, commanding force. Emptiness is form. It felt like all that existed in the world were these tremendous waves washing through my utterly despondent self. I was deeply attached, losing, hurting, loving. There was nothing to do but include an awareness wave after wave of grief. Yet as this heart-wrenching pain was happening, I also felt a soft presence, a compassionate being with my grief. These huge swellings of sadness were held in the space and kindness of awareness. When I asked who was aware, the stream of sore, aching, heavy sensations were appearing and unfolding in a vast and open awareness. As I let go into this wakeful openness, there was no self who owned the grieving, and no friend to lose. I was seeing how this acutely vivid display was just happening, like the movement of the wind or the sudden darkening before a storm. Form is emptiness. There was only the tender field of awareness experiencing the arising and passing of life. All of our emotions, perhaps grief especially, if met with radical acceptance, can carry us to the truth of the Heart Sutra. Poet David White writes, "Those who will not slip beneath the still surface on the well of grief, turning downward through its black water to the place we cannot breathe. We'll never know the source from which we drink, the secret water, cold and clear, nor find in the darkness glimmering the small round coin.